Hi everyone, I'm Chris Aldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. This month, we're interviewing Dr. David Garcia, who is an associate professor with the Mary Lou Fulton Teachers College in the Division of Educational Leadership and Innovation. He is also the director of the Arizona Education Policy Initiative at Arizona State University. Dr. Garcia has held several positions as a research and policy analyst in the Arizona Department of Education, and has twice been nominated to run for statewide elected office, once for the Arizona Superintendent of Public Instruction, and another time as Arizona Governor in 2018. In this month's episode, Professor Garcia talks a bit about his new book, Teach Truth to Power: How to Engage in Education Policy. We hope you enjoy this month's episode and that you find it useful. So, what motivated you to write this book?
So I was motivated by two central problems to write Teach Truth to Power. The first was I've run for statewide office in Arizona twice. First for the state superintendent of public instruction, which is the head education office here in the state, and then for governor. And in those two runs, the word segregation, a question about segregation, only came up once in two statewide runs. And if you Google segregation, at the time I wrote the book, there were over 2 million hits on Google Scholar with the word segregation. I just recently did a session and somebody Googled it, and we're up to almost 3 million hits that have segregation. And so the central problem to me is, how can somebody who runs for an office related to education run for that office and only have segregation brought up to them once? Yet we as an academic community have written about it in some form and almost 3 million hits, right? And I understand that folks out there say, yes, there's a gap between research and policy, and I get it. But the second motivation to this book was, I haven't seen anybody write on concretely how you close that gap. We do a lot to identify what the problem is, to problematize it, to complicate it, to create some theories. Very, very few, if any, resources I've seen out there have some concrete advice for researchers to close the gap between research and policy, and in this case also to include politics. And so that became another motivation. I have unique experience. Not very many people have seen. I've kind of been to all, seen a sort of all, seen three sides of this triangle. Been on the academic side, have been on the policy and staff side, but also on the political side as a statewide candidate. And so that's what motivated me to write the book. We got a problem out there, and the book hopefully is going to give us, you all, us researchers, an opportunity to close that gap and make use of our work.
So I'm curious, you talk a little bit about this in the book, but was your goal always to run for elected office?
No, that was not my goal at all. I've had been around politicians. I worked at the state legislature, had the opportunity to join the staff of a number of politicians. I didn't like the politics. There's too many personalities in politics. I like the policy. I like being able to follow data, to have a civil conversation about ideas. I enjoyed that. But I realized in that process, and the truth is, I got tired of running analyses for politicians who either A, didn't understand them, or B, didn't want to listen to them. And I realized, and it was a tough realization for me, that if we wanted to have the kind of policy impacts that we aspire to as a research and as an academic community, we needed to go through politics. And the way to go through politics is to step forward and put your hat in the arena and run. I'd had background. I'd been around it. I knew it well enough to go into it with my eyes wide open. Put together two really good statewide runs in the process. But it was never my goal was to go into politics at all.
So one of the things that I learned early on in my read of the book, and that I didn't fully understand sort of on this side, me being a researcher, is the complexity of elected office, right? You talk a little bit about this, and you make a distinction between, oftentimes within the research community, we think of something as a policy maker, but you describe a much more complex organizational structure. So for listeners who may not be familiar with the process of policy making and how that's connected to politicians, how would you break down that organizational structure and how researchers are a part of that?
At the policy level, you got two people. You got politicians and you have professional staff. That's what you have. And professional staff are anywhere from, let's say, legislative staff, heads of departments, for example, agency heads. At the school district level, you've got governing board members who are politicians, and you've got superintendents and district staff who are professional staff. It's actually a very clean split. Now, we throw them all into this group called policymakers. And to me, I think because we do that, we really misrepresent what we know. And I think really most damaging is we misrepresent how to apply it. Because anybody working in a policy context, Chris, would tell you, you don't approach staff the same way you approach the politician, right? So I was professional staff in a couple different sessions. As professional staff, I was a grad student at the University of Chicago, knee deep in research methods. My bosses, one was an engineer, the other one was a longtime lobbyist. They weren't education experts at all. And I saw academics come in. They were insurance salesmen. They were all kinds of things. They certainly weren't researchers and education researchers at that. And I saw people come in and approach my bosses, my political bosses, as if they were academics and researchers, and they're not, right? And likewise, folks who came in and assumed I was running the politics was wrong too, because we sometimes say we're going to go and convince the staffer. And yeah, staffers are really important and they're very helpful. Professional staff are. But they can only go as fast and as far as their political bosses are willing to go. If you're a staffer that gets out ahead of your political bosses with your policy ideas, you're going to get fired. And so there are some really severe constraints around professional staff, even though they understand our research, even though we may even share a lot of commonalities with what we read and how we understand research. Only so much that staff can do. And so most recently, for example, I just finished a scoping review and I looked at the research utilization literature in education, and I split out the samples by those who had professional staff in them and those who had research politicians in them. Most of our studies, Chris, have been done with professional staff. These are experts. They know the research. Even the models that we rely on quite a bit, the Enlightenment model, for example, from Weiss, that wasn't developed with politicians. That was developed with professional staff, right? And so it's pretty straightforward when you think about it that way. You got people, and politicians, by the way, only become politicians because they win elections. And so they have a whole nother set of concerns. They have a whole nother skill set that they talk to. The people they talk to face-to-face aren't the same as professional staff. You know, professional staff get together with experts. Politicians have used much more general information to communicate to a much more general audience.
So building on that question, you talk a bit in the book about the role of knowledge of politicians, about both educational research and policy. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what you describe as half knowledge, what that means and how that impacts the way that researchers try to have these relationships either with staff or with politicians.
I really appreciate you pulling out half knowledge, because it is it's not a well-cited theory. In fact, it's kind of embedded into an academic's response to another academic's theory. But when I was looking, there are a lot of theories about policy implementation, about policy creation, whether it's a kind of a mechanical model, a garbage can model, whatever the case may be. You know, I didn't find any of those particularly applicable to my role as a staffer, right? So, you know, I had the opportunity to sit with a number of politicians in various contexts and have people come in and present what they know. First, us academics should know we're not the only people that come in with data. Everybody comes in with data. Now, we think our data is better for a number of important methodological reasons, but even your community group who's showing up to get a little thing done like a speed bump in their neighborhood, they show up with data, right? And so I was looking through trying to try to find a theory that would help explain what I saw happening behind closed doors. And I ran into half knowledge. And the idea of half knowledge is that politicians have a full understanding of the problem, right? They understand the scope of the problems, they do. But they intentionally filter out what they call surplus knowledge for the purposes of trying to determine those key pieces of knowledge or information that they need. And here's the key, to take action. We don't show up often to help politicians take action. We often, as academics, show up to help politicians understand our research. Sometimes we show up to problematize something, But those, both of those circumstances, if I were sitting there in a staff position and somebody came in and problematized something for a politician and didn't pull them into an action, didn't make them do anything, when that academic left, I would turn to the politician, because truth is, I did this a number of times, and I'd tell them, there's nothing you need to know here. Right. And a number of times in a meeting, you'll meet with somebody. They'll say thank you. They'll leave. They'll keep staff back there. And do you know what they ask the staff? Tell me what I need to know. And the staff boils it down. And I'm not going to make your case for you. If you didn't make a strong case for a politician to take action on your issue, if you problematized it and you feel better about making it more complex, but they don't understand it, and I don't see any political implications, I'm going to turn to the politician, and every good staffer does this, and says, Chris, there's nothing you need to know here. You can move on, and you'll move on to another topic, right? So half knowledge is interesting, because I think sometimes we believe that politicians don't know what's going on. And if we can only explain it to them, then they'll see it. And that's actually not what I saw. They understood that there were bigger problems out there. There are some huge problems out there. The people who were most effective with them brought them enough information in a distilled way so that they could take action. Because even though I can explain the problem to you, what they want to know is, what can I do about it? What do you want me to do about it? And there's that step that we really don't do well as academics, because like I said, we often believe our goal is to get politicians to understand our research, not to figure out how to act from our research specifically.
So along those lines, you talk about the idea of being shovel ready and all of these things that are going into this machine of how policymakers or how politicians make decisions. And you say research is one of those things that isn't shovel ready. So in thinking about what you just said about half knowledge, so what does shovel ready mean, and how can we begin to move there as researchers?
Yeah. So shovel ready is, I think, you know, is a policy term, right? When a project is ready to go, you just got to press the button. It's shovel ready. It's ready to dig into the ground and get going. Research isn't shovel ready. And I'm not saying that as a criticism of research, by the way, because it's not intended to be shovel ready for one main reason. Every politician wants as much information as possible about their context and their constituents. And as a staffer, I would gather as much information as I could for a politician on their context, on their jurisdiction. If you were a politician, you'd be looking for the exact same information. Here's the problem. By definition, we generalize our research. We don't have research on your jurisdiction, Chris, if you were a politician. We've got research that was done elsewhere, right? It was done, we can't even really tell you who it was on. And all of that for anonymity and IRB and human subjects purposes. And so it always has to be generalized to your context. And then if you walk into another office, to the next context and to the next context. And so it's not shovel ready because it isn't applicable and it isn't detailed enough for any specific politician to know how their constituents, the people that they're going to have to see face to face, by the way. You know, one of the things we may not appreciate is, even though we don't have names and faces associated with our samples and our researchers, politicians very much do. They go back home again. They know who people are. They see them face to face. They know who key, you know, on a personal level. And good staffers, good people who lobbyists, by the way, do this a lot. They don't come in with a general research, information or general study. They come in and say, Chris, here's the numbers for your district. And so if you think about it for a second and you found that the research said X, but the numbers in your district said Y, you, even as talented and as much of invested in research as you are, like I am too, you'd pay a lot of attention to how it applied to your constituents. So it isn't shovel ready, but it's not intended to be shovel ready, right? I mean, you know, if we start asking our research to do this, we're not doing research anymore. We're basically doing evaluations or accounting ultimately. And that's not what we do. And so I say that not to criticize research, but to free it up for, you know, what its main purpose is. Now, what research has the ability to do, and I think is super powerful here, is it has the ability to predict. And there, I believe we're in a fantastic position as academics to help politicians. Again, for some reason, we like to tell the history of our of our subject all the way up to present day. And that sounds like a really interesting thing to do. But if I, anytime I work with politicians and I advise people to go in a policy environment, I tell them, look, just cut all that out. They don't want to know the history of your topic from, you know, 1920 to now. Here's what they want to know. They want to know what's going to happen next. What we can provide as researchers and as academics that your lobbyist and your constituent group that walks in the door cannot, because we've got that scope of our subject over time, is we can help politicians predict what's going to happen next. And so if you walk into a politician's office with research behind you and you predict what's going to happen next and you're accurate, guess what? They're going to call you back again. And they're going to ask you, all right, Chris, what's going to happen if I pass this bill? What's going to happen next over here? That's the primary focus. And that goes back to half knowledge, because that's going to help you take action.
So another thing you talk about in terms of this shift from to make research relevant and impactful for policy is this idea of a one pager. So for listeners who aren't familiar with this, what is the one pager and why is it so effective?
So in the legislative context, one of the first things you're taught as an intern is to write a one pager, to take a complex bill and to turn it into one page for politicians to consume the key details of that bill in a really quick order, right? And it's a very common approach in legislative circles to boil everything down to something that can fit on a page. So I take that basic idea and I apply it to how we should be presenting research. And, you know, the idea here is that it's very different. This is not a summary of an executive summary of your research. That's not what this one pager is. What it is it starts with a practical problem, a real world condition that is getting worse or could get better. That's the key. Look, I do research. You do research. Politicians don't want to read it for research sake. They get engaged in your research because it can help them solve a problem. Go back to half knowledge. It can help them take action. So start with that real world problem. Now, we don't often understand what our real world problem is, or we lose it over time. In an academic sense, lack of understanding or limited research on a topic is enough to engage in research. That's not a practical problem from a politician's perspective, because there's not a real world problem that's getting worse or could get better, right? So it's really thinking about so what, so what, so what. One of the things I write in the book that I came to a conclusion is segregation is not a real world problem in and of itself. The effects of segregation are the real world problem, right? And I came to that conclusion because as I was on the campaign trail, even though people didn't mention segregation to me directly, some of the problems they faced, I knew were connected to segregation. You know, they had a leaky roof and they wanted the roof to get fixed. And I knew that went back to property values and segregated neighborhoods and redlining. I knew it was tied to segregation, but I couldn't talk about it that way, because for them, they wanted their roof fixed. And if I tie it back to segregation, then the logic goes like this. I got to desegregate schools to fix your roof. No, that's not what they wanted. They wanted their roof fixed, right? And so, you know, one of the things in the book that I'm happy to talk to others about is how do you take what you do and turn it into a real world problem? I'll give you another really good example. I mention it a lot, but it's probably one of my favorites. I had a student come into my class, and his practical problem initially was he wanted to save physics. All right, so what's the real world problem associated with saving physics? And he started with, well, if we don't have good physicists out there, buildings are going to fall down. Okay, well, how many buildings have you seen fall down realistically? No, none of them, right? And so he worked at this. I give him a ton of credit. And he changed his practical problem. He did a survey, like a census of physics teachers across Arizona, and found out there was a dismal number of people teaching physics who were actually trained in physics. I want to say it was less than 40, right, across the entire state. Then he broke that up by legislative district, and he walked in and he said, Representative Saldana, you got a problem. What's that? You have one physics teacher in your entire district. Or you have zero teachers in your entire district. And it was highly effective, because now you could concentrate on that. You could focus on that. You could say, we need some more physics teachers. Or, you know, what it means is you have students traveling really far to take a physics class, right? And so that turned out to be really, really effective. But you know, you start this with a practical problem. You present your research in a more simplified form. You describe what the results are, what they mean, not just what they are. So, you know, you got a mean score of whatever, 6. So is that high? Is that low? Does it mean that the program needs to be changed? Does it mean, you know, you got to get past that? And then the key part here, too, is we end the one pager with an ask. It is a direct, specific yes, no question that you're asking somebody in front of you to do. It doesn't need to be grand, but it has to be specific and it has to be direct. And one of the things people may not realize is that policy changes or is influenced by the accumulation of all these little asks along the way. So the research one pager ends with the ask, and it's the most important part of the one pager, because that is where you tell politicians specifically what you want them to do, what action they can take. Now, the ask doesn't need to be grand, but it has to be specific and direct, and it has to be in a yes no format. And the ask is important because the accumulation of asks, right? People look at policy and they see it's changed, but they don't realize how many little things happen along the way. Your ask, you have to be specific, and building on them is what starts to have an influence. And so you can ask, for example, if you're meeting with a community member, for them to connect you with another community member. You can ask a politician to attend a meeting. You can ask, you can ask their staff, for example, to get back to you or to connect with you or to call you. And it helps build a relationship, but it also helps to start generate some motivation and some momentum for your policy. Now, we aren't very good at asks. And a lot of times I find when politicians walk in, their ask of the politician is basically to understand their research. But that's not enough. That's a softball ask. You want to ask them something directly. And I think people sometimes get a little concerned about this, but they may not appreciate that as a politician, or at least aspiring politician who ran two statewide campaigns, politicians are absolutely accustomed to being asked and to ask. You win an election because you ask a lot of people for a lot of things along the way. And so it is not going to be seen as something that is out of the ordinary in a political context, is to have a direct, specific ask.
You mentioned a little bit earlier about it's good to meet politicians before they become politicians. And I'm curious if you can talk a little bit more about that. And in particular, how politicians receive information, which information they're most likely to trust. Because, for example, you could imagine that crisis happens, something like a teacher shortage, something like NAEP results come out like they did this month. And as a researcher, we may say, oh, I'm an expert in that. Let me reach out to this politician. But I'm curious if you can talk a little bit more about how information gets into the hands of politicians and the kinds of channels through which that can be shaped and influenced.
Well, working at the legislature is a lot like Groundhog's Day. The same folks come with the same positions every year, right? They do. And as a staff member there, I would walk up to a group and I'd say, look, do you got anything new? And if they said no, I'd move on because they would. People come up and they say, here's a latest, you need to read this research. I know the research is going to support their policy positions. Why? Because they're giving it to me, right? So it becomes really, really predictable. Let me give the listeners another way to think about this. Another way to get your research to get attention politically is to get an unlikely ally to take it. Somebody who the politician isn't expecting to take it and bring it to them. It didn't happen very often, but it did happen every once in a while. I had somebody come in as an unlikely ally who wasn't necessarily tied directly to education, but came in to support an education issue. And that stands out for a number of reasons. It breaks up the rhythm and the usual suspects and the kind of the refrain of political policy actors. But it also shows a political collaboration you should pay attention to if two people are coming together that you wouldn't imagine are coming together. And so, a couple different examples I have is when I need to get something in front of the newspaper, for example, I can call them, but they're going to expect me to tell them my report's good because it's my report. I could get you to do it, Chris, but they could expect my colleague to call them and say David's report is good. What I will do, and what works really effectively, is I'll get somebody who's not in education at all, somebody like a business developer or somebody from a nonprofit, and I'll have them read it. And then I'll sit down with them and we'll talk about it. And I'll say, will you do me a favor? Will you call the press for me and just tell them you read it and you think this is good? Now that starts to change things, because the press goes, wait a minute, why is this guy calling about Garcia's study on property values and the impact on, you know, school construction in the West Valley kind of thing, right? And, you know, that goes a long, long way. And so how you get there, and I think, you know, we often go to affinity groups, some kind of affiliated group, people we know well, we get along with them well, we give them their research. But guess what? When they show up with our work, it's basically the same thing that was there the year before, that's going to be there the year after. You know, if you want to break it up, go out and find some unlikely allies out there who can take your work, and it'll stand out for sure.
So we're coming up towards the end of the podcast. And I always try to end our conversations, hopefully, with some positive affirmations for listeners. And I think it's interesting that your book focuses on at the intersection of research and politics at a time when our politics is so polarized. So I'm curious if, given our political climate, and how at times it seems impossible to accomplish anything, how do you think researchers can work to inform politicians who may share their values, and then while also speaking to the politicians who don't?
Well, I hope this whole thing has been positive, because the truth is, I think that, you know, I wrote the book on a positive note. I mean, it's intended to be prescriptive. It's intended to help people, to help research and academics get through this space and be effective. I believe that good information and good research has a place in the policy discussion. I just believe we need to act differently and go about how we interact with politicians differently. And my hope is that this book gives academics and researchers some concrete ways to do just that. And so, you know, I remain optimistic. But to your point, two things I'd bring up. Number one, the book is informed by lobbyists, because whether we like it or not, if we're going to go ask somebody to rethink their position or change their position, we are lobbying. Now, we may not be official lobbyists, but we are effectively lobbying. So we got to learn from lobbyists. And they'll tell you, you don't distinguish. If somebody who holds your position or somebody who doesn't hold your position is willing to meet with you, you get your presentation ready, you get your one page ready, and you go. Right? You may be surprised at the kind of connections you can make with people. And this is actually in the book, the idea of creating connections with politicians, not just on education, but on other issues that can help you make your point. And so regardless, you know, you're going to get in front of anybody who will listen. I've been in front of politicians who share my view of education and politicians who very much do not. But if you can get there, that's helpful. So, but in this polarized world, one of the things that is still has currency is prediction. What's going to happen next? Whether we and being able to get out ahead of that, in front of that, helping politicians to understand that, look, you can maintain confidentiality. You're not going to go out to the press. And it's one of the challenges, I believe, with academics who are advocates is if you're a politician, you really can't trust academic advocates, because they're going to go out and tell the world, but if we can maintain our sense of objectivity and following the research questions the way that I know we often do, going and predicting and having politicians understand what's going to happen next is valuable regardless of your political stripe. So I still think there's a place for us there. And I hope the book is a blueprint and an opportunity and a chance for people to understand exactly how to go about doing that when they're ready.
Thank you, Dr. Garcia, for sharing with us today about your book, Teach Truth to Power, How to Engage in Education Policy. As always, we hope you're safe and healthy. And remember that for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu. And follow NEPC on Twitter @NEPCTwitter.